Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we will be talking a bit about writing for television, comedy particularly. And our guest here is someone who has quite a bit of experience in this area. His name is Fred Rubin. And since 1977, he served as writer on 15 network series and has produced shows including Different Strokes, Archie Bunker's Place, Mama's Family, Webster, Night Court, Family Matters, Step by Step, Two of a Kind. He's written 60 episodes of primetime television, 10 pilots, and 2 made-for-TV movies. At the moment, he teaches. He teaches at UCLA and USC, comedy writing and screenwriting. He's also been a script consultant. He's a guest instructor for the Warner Brothers Writers Workshop, Pixar University, the Disney Writers Fellowship, and the ABC Talent Development Program. And right at the moment, he is here spending some time at Unit 1 as guest in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall. And we'll be here for this week talking with students and anybody else who's interested about the business, about writing comedy, about how to succeed in Hollywood. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois, by the way. Graduated here from the U of I in 1972 with a BFA in directing and playwriting. And we're pleased to have him here. And as we talk, as always, questions are welcome. People who are listening can call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks for being here.
Hey, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think that it's fair to say that, every year, new television programs, comedies, dramas premiere, and that the number that are really successful is small.
That's
there are
true.
Always shows they air maybe half a dozen times or less, and they're gone.
That's true. It's an incredible crapshoot to try and get a successful series up and running. And we have in Hollywood what they call pilot season. At a certain point in the year, the network orders pilots to be written. There's literally hundreds and hundreds of ideas that are pitched to the network. And then they hone it down to maybe I don't have the exact statistics, but we'll say something like they'll order several hundred pilots to be written. And then once they're written, of those 700 that get written, only a small percentage get picked to be made, shot, and tested. And of those that are made, shot, and tested, even a smaller percentage get launched at the beginning of the new season. And of those that are launched at the beginning of the new season, 4 or 5 might survive the whole year and go on to be what they call a hit for the next season.
Well, if you look at those things that seem to be standout, let's say situation comedies, programs that seem to be standout shows that were both, let's make it harder, shows that were both popular and critical successes, and probably for people who watch television and like comedy, everybody's maybe going to have their favorites, depending on what period you're talking about, maybe. So, but if you look at it, those shows that are successful, is it possible to say anything about what those things have in common? What contributed to the success of the show?
Well, some people would disagree with me, but generally, the more successful shows have very strong creative people in charge that are able to stand up to the pressures of the studios and the network and either stick by their guns or get the networks and the studios to give them enough of an opportunity so that they don't fail. Now, it's commonly assumed, for example, let's take a show like Cheers. That's probably one of the most popular shows of all times. It was not critically successful. In fact, in the first year it ran, it was in danger of being canceled many times. But the creative people behind it were strong enough, and the network people behind it had enough gumption to say, all right, let's keep it on. Let's keep it on for whatever reason. Let's keep it on. And often this is a problem with many shows. There's a lot of quality shows that never get the chance because it's so costly to air them. Mm-hmm. And people cut and run way too quick. The better shows, Saturday Night Live, look at that. It's what is it? I'm guessing maybe the longest running show on television right now, possibly.
Maybe.
There's a show that struggled a long time before it found its audience. The overall problem is the networks don't have enough time, patience, or money to keep a show on for very long to let it succeed, and that's the problem. And the ones that do, well, sort of the stars align. You know, there's a certain magic that happens.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it's like if you ask somebody, well, how do you produce a successful movie? The answer would be, well, if I could tell you that, I would be doing it. If there was a stock answer, everybody would be doing it. So obviously, there are some things that just all go right. Maybe you have a great cast. Maybe you have really good writers. Maybe, you know, all those things.
Invariably, the shows that stay on and work generally have somebody running them, an executive producer writer, who has a clear vision of what that person wants, clear vision of what he or she wants, has an inherent talent, has an inherent control over the actors. And generally, that's what makes a show work. And of course, the rapport of the actors or the quality of the actors has a great deal to do with it. But most people would tell you it's all time slot. You know, essentially, if you put on an hour of clever dog food commercials in close proximity to American Idol, it'd probably be a hit.
Yeah. Well, that's something
sad but true.
Something that, though, has changed a lot since the time, say, that we were kids and watching television. It seemed to me that time slots and schedules were pretty rigid. Once a program was slotted in a particular place, networks didn't go moving things around. And it seems like what has happened more in, you know, last 20 years is that they'll put in a program one place, and if it doesn't seem to be doing well, they'll put it someplace else.
Yeah.
Or maybe even if they're trying to build some other program and they have one other program that's strong, so that that seemed like you see an awful lot of churning in the schedule that you know, years ago you just didn't see that. And I wonder, in fact, does that frustrate people who make the programs because
Absolutely.
They say, you know, nobody can figure out when the show's on if you keep moving it around.
Absolutely. It's very frustrating. And we're not exactly codgers, but you have to keep in mind that when we were kids, there was a lot fewer things on TV.
Yeah.
TV was even when we were kids, they were struggling for product. You know, they weren't sure. They were struggling for products, so they were apt to give a show more of an opportunity. They just didn't have the massive amount of product. And so moving the time slot is always frustrating, you know, for a showrunner and the people that are writing a show. It's always frustrating. But again, these days, your expectations are not that high. You know, if you can even get a show on the air, that's a pretty big accomplishment these days. I'm proud to say some of my students and some of the people I mentored are doing it. They've had it done and they're doing it. I'd also like to, because I know you touched on this area, mention a quote. It's the most often quoted phrase about Hollywood. It's from the William Goldman book, Adventures in the Screen Trade. And the quote is, "Nobody knows anything."
Yeah.
And it's true. Nobody – who would have thought, for example – that a show where B-level celebrities dancing with dancers would be the most popular show in America. Who in their right mind would have believed that's going to beat, you know, everything?
Yeah. It's strange how things, and I suppose it's always been that way, that certain concepts, certain ideas catch on. Somebody does something, and it's new, and it's different, so people watch. And then of course, everybody else says, oh, we've got to have one of these. So it seems to me that now, and I blame Rob Burnett for this, that shows like Survivor and American Idol have begot so many other programs now. It seems that we're sort of awash in stuff like that.
Well, we are. I'm pleased to say a lot of them have failed. There's as in every format, as in our format, as in sitcom, as in news magazines, there's always a few engines that will chug on. Right now, American Idol seems to be unstoppable. The Great Race is still pretty popular. Survivor still seems to be working, but a whole passel of other ones have fallen by the wayside. Although there's, you know, new ones always coming along. It's the same thing with comedies. It's kind of that feeling that you throw a bunch of things at the wall and two or three of them will stick. That's just fate, you know.
It must also be frustrating. I'm sure that it's frustrating for writers to see all of these things that are called reality programs. And, of course, as we all know, the reality shows are not real. They're stage managed and they're heavily produced and edited. And I'm sure there actually are also writers who are involved in those programs.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that it's not quite the same thing as, I'm sure, as something where you are actually creating a project or coming up with a concept. You're really you're writing dialogue for actors. And it's, I'm sure that's different, and that writers look at these other shows and just, you know, shake their heads.
Well, reality is it's like a plague to a real writer. It speaks against everything that we do, and little by little it invades the work opportunities that we have, and it takes them away. But for the most part, those of us that have been around for a while, we know that television, if anything, it's imitative, like you said, but it's cyclical. Things go in cycles, and it never stays the same. It's like the stock market. You know, the stock market can plunge and plunge and plunge, but it's always going to come back up. Sitcoms, for example, right now, there is not a sitcom in the top 10 consistently. I think the other day I was looking and I didn't see one in the top 20, which is unheard of because 10 years ago, five of the top 10 shows were sitcoms. And people get scared when this happens, but you have to remind them. I tell my students, for example, in 1960, do you know what the top 10 shows were? Do you, Dave?
No, of course not.
They were Westerns.
Really?
All top 10 shows in 1960 on television were Westerns. Where are they now? They're gone.
Yeah.
Now, sitcom has at least the people always need to laugh. People always need to kind of zone out, forget their troubles, and laugh. And sitcom has the history of bouncing back. For example, I don't remember what year The Cosby Show came out, but I was heavily in the industry that year. And every comedy writer I knew was writing an hour sample script because it was in TV Guide. Sitcom is dead. And then Bill Cosby Show aired, and it brought the whole genre right back in spades. It brought it back just hugely.
Yeah. Producing series television is really expensive, and I'm sure that certain kinds of programs, say, you know, take a show like ER. I'm sure that that's really expensive. Part of the reason is that as the show has become popular, the actors their salaries have gone up pretty dramatically.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm sure that that may be one of the advantages that a sitcom would have, again, depending on what your cost for talent would be, is that it would cost much less to do 13 half-hour comedy
show. None of it costs less than a reality show. Reality shows are so inexpensive to produce and so inexpensive to shoot, and especially these reality shows that center around somebody's house or somebody's, you know, lifestyle. That's one of the reasons why they're doing so well as far as the networks. They're much cheaper to produce than comedies. I don't know the exact dollar amount it costs to shoot a comedy pilot today. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking it's somewhere around the area of $2 million with the total investment to just shoot one. And even on the shows that I worked on, I think they cost about $1 million per episode to do. And that also depends on the cast. You look at Friends in the last year, each one of those actors was making $1 million an episode.
Yeah.
So that's $6 million right off the top of every episode. It can be a lot of money.
Yeah, that's I wonder as a writer, somebody who's on the production end, how you think about that. I guess on the one hand, you could say, well, that was greedy, and I guess on the other hand, you have to say, well, if you're an actor, you have to say to yourself, you know, I might never work again. You know, that's not impossible. So maybe you say, okay, I'll get as much as I possibly can.
Well, you know, even people that make tremendous amounts of money sometimes look at it and go, this really is absurd. This is really unrealistic. But as a writer and a staunch member of the union, and as a writer who's been on strike for three times, I understand why. And it's because the ultimate profit of the studio and the network is so gigantic with a hit series. It's so beyond comprehension. It's not fair to pay the writers and the actors a tiny percentage. And whenever we're on strike, people always say to me, how can you do this? How can you be asking for more money? And I say, it's like this. If I own a car, and like the network owns the show, and I sell it to you for $1,000, and then you turn around and sell it to somebody for $30,000, who's the idiot, me or you? And that's exactly what it's like. It's like a writer gets paid so much money to write. Everything starts with the word. Everything starts with the script. Without the writer, without the script, there is nothing. So you sell your services for X amount of dollars, and then suddenly it's on DVDs in every borders in the country. Yeah. Suddenly it's on your iPod. People are making fortunes off these things, and you only are making a small percentage of that. Now, granted, I'm not complaining. Don't get me wrong. The Writers Guild always fights for these new technologies and getting us a share. But in comparison to what the studios and the networks make, it's nothing.
Yeah. Well, that you touch on something that you're right. You go to the video rental place now and you see shelves and shelves of television programs.
Yeah, exactly.
And now there's, I guess, for a long time there has been syndication, but now
DVDs.
DVDs shows are rerun on various cable stations, and you know a successful program can have a very long life now in syndication. Now, do writers particularly, but people who are involved in producing programs, are they now negotiating
more, in fact,
of a piece of the what happens after it has its first run?
Well, how big of a piece we're going to end up getting in these new technologies hasn't been determined yet, but it's going to be big issues for all the guilds, the Writers Guild, the Producers Guild, the Directors Guild, the Actors Guild. It's going to be big issues. There was a time in the history of the Guild where we had this was in videotapes. This was when the issue was videotapes. And a faction of the Guild said, we cannot fold. We must hold out against these videotapes, because some people realized one day on every corner there's going to be a place where you can rent our shows. But there was a faction that folded and said, that's not going to happen. And look where we are now. The most popular selling DVDs are of the television genre are sitcoms. Mm. And by the way, if your listeners are interested, I'm featured on the first season of Different Strokes, the DVD. You can see me in person on that and hear some commentary that I do on some of the episodes.
Our guest here this morning is Fred Rubin. He's a television screenwriter. Right now, he's guest in residence at Unit 1 on Allen Hall. He'll be speaking, leading workshops, performing every night of his residency. He served as writer on 15 TV network series and has been producer of programs like Different Strokes, Archie Bunker's Place, Mama's Family, Webster Night Court, Family Matters, Two of a Kind. He's written 60 episodes of primetime TV, 10 pilots, one made-for-TV movie. Right now, he's a freelance script consultant and also adjunct professor at UCLA and USC in the departments of cinema and television. And if you have questions, you certainly can call in. I don't know if I gave the number at the beginning. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455.
By the way, I might add just for your listeners that I also teach screenwriting and have an independent feature in development. So if any of your listeners have questions about that, I might be a good person to ask.
All right. Well, here's a caller. Somebody ready to go here in a community not too far away. Leroy, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The Book of Daniel seems like it was billed originally as a sitcom, and it had a pretty short life on air. Any insight into what happened? And if I might, I'd hang up and listen.
Okay.
Forgive me, I am not familiar with the Book of Daniel. Was that a religious or a spiritual-based series?
Well, sort of. It was a series that revolved around a guy, Aidan Quinn, starred, and he played a minister, man of the cloth, with flaws. And it was one of these things where everybody was sort of screwed up somehow.
Right.
And Jesus would appear in there and would talk to him.
Right.
These little conversations.
Right.
It was very controversial, and I think it lasted 3 episodes.
Well, you know, I now know which show you're talking about, and I do know that spirituality per se, and religious elements are finding their way into mainstream primetime. The show Rescue Me, which is an hour show, utilizes a lot of conversations directly with Jesus. Dennis Leary has these conversations with him all the time. Joan of Arcadia, which I think is a successful show, is based around a girl that talks to God. And so I do think that television, little by little, is making way for more spirituality in the programming. However, to tell your listener this, comedies based in the religious area have classically never done well in the history of sitcoms. A rare exception was the show Amen, which was on, 15 years ago, which lasted a few years, which was based around a church and a ministry and the parishioners in the church. But classically, and when I saw the Book of Daniel was airing, I thought to myself, well, what network is going to try this again? Classically, for some reason, comedy based in those areas hasn't taken off. There's always an occasional character. For example, Father Mulcahy on MASH, that rings true and clear with an audience, that an audience likes. But comedies based in religious areas, for some reason, generally don't do well. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the answer to that is, except that maybe it's too serious an area to make too much fun of.
You know, I actually saw a couple of episodes of the program, and actually thought it was really just not a very good show, and I don't think that had anything to do with mocking religion or religious themes. And I guess it would be hard to separate out if people said they didn't like it. Was it because of that, or was it because they just thought it wasn't a very good program and it just didn't do anything?
Again, nobody knows anything for sure. But what they do when these shows air, they test them with audience testing groups. Pardon the pun, they test them religiously, and the ratings are very important. And if a show doesn't catch some spark of interest right away, or if it's having problems getting produced, they'll just yank it. They'll just yank it. Yeah. It's gone.
Well, that's, I suppose, the same. We see the same thing with feature films, because there's so much product, and what studios, they spend so much money that they want to make an enormous amount of money right out of the box. And they feel like if they don't right away, and I'm sure that exhibitors put some pressure on the distributors, if they have a movie and it's not doing well, they say, get this dog out of here. Give me something that will get people into the theater to watch the movie.
Opening weekend is the flop sweat time. That's where people, and every year, how much money you have to make opening weekend goes up and up and up. However, I do believe that, especially this year with the success of indie features, which were more word of mouth, people just loved these movies and went to see them. And on their own scale, they did very well. Studios are beginning to understand, rather than spend $300 million on a movie and then have it just break even or just do moderately well, it's much better to spend $5 million on a movie and have it make $80 million, which that can happen. Mm. And, of course, foreign sales is very important now. How a movie can bomb here and then overseas do incredibly well.
And the studio can still make a lot of money.
Oh, make more than you can imagine. Mm. And by the way, that's also true with television. That's another issue where television writers and creators are still getting the short end of the stick. When the rules about foreign sales were invented, they were minimal. Now the biggest product that America exports overseas is television.
Yeah. 333-9455. That's here for Champaign Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. We'd like to talk with our guest television screenwriter, Fred Rubin. Not very long ago, maybe within the last couple of years, there was a feature here. We had it on one of the NPR shows, though that was kind of interesting. Some guys had put together a website where they had gone out and gotten some television pilots that were produced but were never picked up.
That
at least they thought were kind of interesting and people might want to see them. And so they were putting them there so that you could go and watch them. And that sort of raises this question of, well, you know, would the idea be viable that you could produce a show, or maybe if you managed to get it produced, it didn't get distributed or didn't get picked up, that now we have potential alternative methods for distributing shows that completely goes around the networks.
Yeah, one of the great things we've got going for us now, which wasn't a trend in the past, is when a quality show that can't get the audience that the network needs gets yanked, there are other buyers. For example, Arrested Development, which happened to be one of my favorite shows, and I think I can safely say among comedy writers, it was a highly respected show. We loved it. Mm-hmm. Could not get an audience. I teach it at UCLA and USC every week, and my students would be raving about this show, and yet the networks could. And usually, when college students, for example, love a show, that's a good sign. Family Guy was literally brought back to life by that kind of cadre of an audience. Things like The Simpsons stay on year after year because there isn't a college student on the planet that doesn't love The Simpsons. But I understand Arrested Development, which has finally been yanked from the Fox schedule, is being shopped around to other networks, and possibly HBO or Showtime might pick it up.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, again, that's another one of these things where I'm sure right now already you can start watching it on DVD.
I know for a fact the first season is already out on DVD. And that is, in fact, what brought Family Guy back. Family Guy was a dead series. It was off the air. Nobody else picked it up. It was gone. The DVD sales were so popular that the studio realized, you know, if we do another season of this, we're going to make even more money selling the DVDs.
Yeah. I think didn't also the fact that it was picked up by the Cartoon Network and was airing on Cartoon Network and maybe people saw it who hadn't seen it before helped?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Those kind of supplementary markets can really do it. By the way, just for my own ego, I was a featured character on Family Guy once.
Were you now?
And it was the highlight of my career to be made into a cartoon.
Did you get to actually do the voice?
You know, foolishly, I didn't even think to ask to do the voice. I was just so blown away that it was actually three of my former students that were on the show, and they called me and said, hey, we want to use you as a character. I had to bring in a photo of myself so the animators could draw me. And, you know, I never even thought to say, oh, you know, I could do the voice, too. But I didn't. But I am out there. And I think they used me in more than one episode, but I am out there in a very well-known episode.
To aspire to be a character on an animated series. What does that say?
Well, I was just a guest character. I played a gynecologist, actually. And among my students, certainly, it gives me the greatest status there is because I can tell them about all the things I've written and all the people I've worked with. But when they realize I was that doctor on that Family Guy episode, it's like I get legend status immediately.
Mm. I would like to maybe have you talk a little bit about right at the beginning. You talked a little bit about the process, or at least about the fact that an enormous for new programs, huge number of pilots are written. They're just written and they only exist on paper. Then of those, a relatively small percentage are selected to be made. Somebody actually says, all right, I'm going to spend the money. We're going to do it. And then of those, again, a very small percentage actually gets picked up, meaning some network or somebody says, all right, I will buy this. And I'm not exactly sure what the commitment is made to, you know, how many of these actually get aired. And then, again, a very small percentage actually even end up being a success. Can you just, based on your own experience, talk a little bit about how that whole process works?
Well, you know, what's the expression? The zebra is a horse designed by a committee. I think that's the expression.
I think, or maybe it was a camel as a horse.
Designed by a committee. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest drawbacks in television is It's a huge committee process. There are many people whose jobs depend on them contributing ideas to the process that aren't necessarily good, aren't necessarily right, don't necessarily help, but their opinions have to be honored and taken into consideration. So there's so many people that have to make decisions about any given project along the way. That's really the main reason why so few of them get to the forefront and so few of them succeed. It's my theory that the ones that do are the ones that have really strong, creative people in charge that can say to the others, no, we're going to do it this way or not at all. And time again, when you see a great movie happen, a great play happen, award-winning play, Pulitzer Prize-winning play, when you see a television show break out, it is almost invariably because the show was popular enough right away that the creators were able to say to the studios and the networks, we want to do it this way and we're going to do it this way. And no, we won't do it that way. The process is really difficult. Mm-hmm. I've written, at least 12 pilots, of which only one ever got produced. And you can make quite a healthy living just writing them, as you can make a healthy living writing movies that never get
produced,
made.
Yeah.
They literally never get shot.
Yeah.
You write a spec screenplay, people bid on it, they buy it for $100,000 or more. And some screenplays get bought for up to $1 million if you've got the right clout. And then nothing ever happens, never even gets made. But hey, you know, that's the way it goes. It's really because there's so much committee stuff going on. It's like trying to pass a law in Congress. That process can take forever, and it can take years and years of work, and it just doesn't happen. Those of us that write television like it much better than screenwriting because there's a more immediacy to it. There's more speed to it. And actually, when you work on a television series, you can have an idea over the weekend. Talk about it on Monday morning. 4 weeks later, you've written a script about it. 2 weeks later, the actors have shot it in front of an audience. And 2 weeks later than that, you know, 15 million people are watching it. You know, from the idea you had over the weekend to 10 weeks later or 8 weeks later, 15 million people are seeing your work, more than anybody even reads a book. I mean, who gets to what novelist in their lifetime gets 15 million readers? So that's one of the most exciting things about TV, especially if you're working on a show. It's immediate. And you, I can't tell you, my wife wrote and produced Home Improvement for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she watched it religiously, but I only watched it sporadically. But now that it's in syndication, I'll be watching an episode and realize that the argument on the show that Tim and Jill are having was our
with
argument,
you guys.
Was my wife's. And you know, it drives you crazy. But that's what most writers do. They bring their lives into a show and find a way to use it in a story.
Yeah. There are, I don't know how many shows there are. Well, maybe ask this question. How many shows are there where one person writes every episode?
There's only a handful. They're mostly hour shows, although it was pretty well known on Seinfeld that Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld were the primary writers. They would get the scripts from the other writers, but they would rewrite shows specifically much more than a lot of shows get rewritten. It's certainly well known that David E. Kelley rewrites almost every episode. I think Aaron Sorkin for a long time was the primary writer. And by that, I mean, he gives the other writers the credit. He gives them the residuals, but he can rewrite any episode substantially. And between you and I don't know how anybody can do it. It's just the most demanding, stressful work. I don't know how people like Aaron Sorkin, David Kelley, Larry David, I don't know how they live their lives and do all that work. It's a tremendous amount of work.
Well, and David Kelley, he has done that with more than one show at a time. He's had a couple of successful shows on at the same time, and he was writing all of them.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I don't know how people like that can do it and have families and have, you know, and my goodness, David E. Kelley is married to Michelle Pfeiffer. Wouldn't you want to spend some time not writing? I certainly would.
for a 30-minute and I'm not sure exactly even how much of it is without the commercials.
22 minutes, roughly.
Okay. For a sitcom, it's a half hour a show.
Right.
How long is one script? One script.
Well, there's two kinds of sitcoms. There's sitcoms that are filmed with a single camera, and generally they don't have an audience. And there's sitcoms that are filmed with three cameras, and they generally have an audience. And there's two different formats of scripts. Now, a single-camera sitcom that's filmed without an audience is written just like a film script. And that comes out to 30 pages. And the format is different than a three-camera. Three-camera sitcom, like Friends, for example, is a three-camera sitcom. That's filmed in front of an audience, and the scripts can be anywhere from 40 to 60 pages long. The difference in the formats for any of your listeners who are thinking about writing is film scripts are single-spaced. All the dialogue is single-spaced, and sitcom format is double-spaced. That's why the pages are longer. It's about the same amount of material, but all the talking is double spaced, so it takes up more pages, and the margins are narrower. So to answer your question, a film sitcom is about 30 pages long, and a three camera sitcom with an audience can be 40 to 60 pages long. I'll tell you an interesting sidebar. I worked on Night Court for 2 years. On Night Court, we would often go to the reading with an 80-page script because the actors were so fast. Their rhythm and their pacing was so fast that they could do an 80-page script in what most casts would do 60. And by the time we edited it during the week, it would be – even we would often shoot a Night Court script that was 60 pages, which is easily 15 pages longer than any other sitcom would do because the actors were so – quick.
Yeah. And does it give your audience enough time to react and get the jokes?
Yeah, what happens, what you hope for with an audience show is that there's so much laughter, then you have to re-edit the whole show and take out more of it to allow for the laughter. When an audience laughs at a joke, it's called a laugh spread. And there's some historically famous laugh spreads in the history of comedy, for example. Lucy in The Chocolate Factory. You must remember that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That has one of the hugest laugh spreads in the history of television. When Archie Bunker opened his grandson's diaper for the first time, changing a diaper, that has one of the longest laugh spreads in the history of sitcom. The audience laughs so hard. And so after a show is filmed in front of an audience, you then have to see how much show do we have to take out to accommodate the laughter that was added.
Well, I'm sure that this all it's a very difficult and sometimes careful. You got to be careful how you pace this because you also want to protect the next joke. You don't want people to, you know, somebody tells one joke, people really laugh. It's really great. So whoever gets the next line, you don't want that to get lost because people aren't paying attention or they're still laughing or
exactly
or whatever.
Well, in editing, of course, you can do anything to manipulate that. You can you can take down the laughter or remove it entirely or cut it by half so that you don't lose the line that follows it.
What do you think about laugh tracks?
You know, there's a common misconception about laugh tracks. Laugh tracks are based on the real laughter of the audience. So during a live audience taping, the audience themselves are recorded. And laugh tracks are only used when the audience totally didn't laugh at a joke. It was clearly a joke. And when you have it in the final edit and you can't take a joke out and there's no laughter there, it lays there and feels quite awkward. So only then will they add artificial laughs. But laugh tracks are only used if the laughter was not substantial on a joke, and then it's augmented. But most of the laughter you hear on a TV show is not false. It's what the audience actually did. And occasionally it's augmented if the executive producer feels like, I think there should be a little bigger laugh here. Or when there was no laughter whatsoever and the joke was just laying there, they'll dub in some laughter. But it's a misconception. Most laughter that you hear while you're watching at home is authentic audience laughter.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me introduce again the guest, Fred Rubin. He's a television screenwriter. He currently is guest in residence at Unit 1 on the U of I campus in Allen Hall. He has served as writer on 15 TV network series, has been producer of such shows as Different Strokes, Archie Bunker's Place, Webster, Night Court, Family Matters. He's written 60 episodes of primetime TV, 10 pilots, and a made-for-TV movie, and currently he works as a freelance script consultant. He is also adjunct professor at both UCLA and USC in their departments of cinema and TV. And if you have questions, you can call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The style that a lot of sitcoms are shot in now, this the live three cameras, live audience. Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz invented that.
Yes, they did.
So that idea they invented it and has been around for a long time.
They also invented the audience being there too.
Yes, yeah. Right in front of the audience. Yeah. You know, the fact that we have those shows now, they're first ones that did it. Of course, greatly successful. I don't know if still somewhere in the world there, somewhere at this very moment, a Lucy episode is airing, but I bet.
Oh, absolutely. Right now, just in the United States, I would imagine this very minute, there's 20 episodes running right now.
So that they invented that back when in the 50s when they were doing the show. Is there anything else that has come along since that was as revolutionary? It seems in a lot of ways, very little in the way those shows are done has changed.
You know, you're absolutely right about that. There is not much. You know, the three camera system, there's a misnomer. It's actually four cameras because there's a camera running all the time that shoots a master shot, so that you can always use the master shot. Of course, there's a lot more technical stuff available in terms of the quality of the picture, the quality of the sound. There's been a lot of improvements in that, the quality of the lighting. And certainly there's a lot more technical things, special effects that can be done, even in front of a live audience. And most sitcoms, even those that are filmed in front of a live audience, will have a scene that isn't because it's loaded with special effects that they have to do. So I would say a green screen has been a tremendous achievement, even in sitcoms. I worked on Family Matters for 2 years. We did incredible stunts on Family Matters. We did an episode where Urkel fell off the Eiffel Tower. And that was a scene that we shot in the studio with green screen. And when you watch it, you can't it actually looks like he fell off the Eiffel Tower. I wrote an episode of Family Matters where the main character, Urkel, and Carl, the father figure on the show, were shrunk down to miniature. It was like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And they were stuck on the kitchen table. And there was a scene where a cantaloupe fell and came rolling after them. It was like a scene out of an Indiana Jones movie. And the effects were seamless. The effects in television can be as good as a feature. And somehow, miraculously, they don't cost as much money either.
Yeah.
So, but in terms of the live audience experience, it's almost exactly the same.
Let's talk with a listener here, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. Fred, I was just wondering, did you bring Mel Torme to Night Court, or did Harry Anderson do that?
I did not bring Mel. It's my pleasure to have worked with him several times. He is a true star. I was in Night Court. I believe the years I worked there was in either the seventh or the eighth season or the eighth or ninth season. But I can tell you how Mel Torme ended up there. Harry Anderson himself was a legitimate fan of Mel Torme, and he must have discussed it with the creator, Reinhold Wiggy, at some point, and they decided to bring him on. I don't know how many appearances he had on Night Court, but he had quite a few, and it increased his contemporary popularity immensely, just immensely. And, of course, he was the Golden Fog. He was a great voice and a very, very nice man to work with.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and by the way, it's good to have you back in town.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Just as a sidebar, you might be interested to know that Hugh Hefner, who is also a University of Illinois graduate, generally hosts a party for various University of Illinois alumni and dignitary at his mansion. It's not a wild party. It's a very sedate event. And at one of those parties, Mel Torme was there. This was several years back, but Mel Torme was a friend of his, too. So there's even a U of I connection with Mel Torme and U of I.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Bye-bye. And other questions are certainly welcome here. Again, I'd say we have about 7-8 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Is there something that you think of that you wrote that you knew it was never – It just couldn't fly. It couldn't happen. But you said to yourself, you know, I really wish I wrote this thing. I would wish I could have done this thing. But I know that there's just no chance.
You know, I can't think of a specific thing that came down that way, David. But I can tell you this. That's one of the unfortunate things about television. As writers, we often think of things and we pitch them, and the executive producer will say, that's too smart. Or that, and there are certain shows on TV, more so family shows, where you know your audience is largely younger children or, you know, sixth, seventh, eighth graders, and you'll come up with a great idea and the comment will be, no, that's too smart. That's a stinger. That's something that's always hard to deal with as a writer. When it's literally saying, let's come up with something that's easier for the audience to understand. And I think the worst shows on television are those that assume that the audience is not very bright, and you have to keep explaining to them and laying things out for them. You've probably been to a movie where you're sitting there and they're laying things out in such a way you're thinking, what do they think? I'm an idiot. I get it. You don't have to tell me this. And again, often there's some committee person that's behind that note. The audience won't understand that. Let's explain it better. That happens all the time.
I guess I'm just thinking about this. Well, one of the things you mentioned was the fact that maybe one of the problems with doing something that's successful is that there are so many people that get their hands in there, and so many people along the line who are in some position that say, no, don't do this, do this. Or, I don't like this, I want you to do this. So it's, you know, we're back to the horse assembled by the committee. That happens. Does it even happen once the show is picked up and it's going?
Yeah, well, where it happens then is from the actors. You know, it's like once a show is successful, the actors who are normally kind of subservient and quiet and cooperative suddenly begin to realize, this show is successful and I'm part of that. So I can now bring up some suggestions the way I think the show should be, the way I think my character can be. Now, I won't name names. There's classic stories in Hollywood, and I've worked with actors that are beyond obnoxious when it comes to this. That when you leave the table after talking to them, you've got a dartboard with their picture on it, and you're throwing the darts at it. There are also actors that are brilliant and collaborative and sensitive, and their suggestions are welcomed, often better than what you had. Yeah. But there's also actors that are notoriously mean-spirited, cranky, and their suggestions are no better or worse than what you had, or often worse than what you have. And there's actors, and great ones, that can take something you've written and make it brilliant, but at the same time they can just ruin it. Mm-hmm. And the more successful shows had somebody that could literally say to the actor, you can't do it that way. Please do it this way. Just listen to us on this one and give it a try. Often shows that have audiences are even better because the audience can prove your point for you. So you can say to an actor, all right, do it your way, and let's see how the audience reacts. And then if it bombs, you can say to the actor, now try it our way. Mm-hmm. And that's often a great proving ground. So after the committee of the studio people, the network people, and let's not forget standards and practices, the people that you negotiate centers with about what you can say and what you can't say. After all these people have mucked with it, then you go to the table to read it. There's always the actors. And again, I can just reiterate, some are brilliant in helping you out. With John Larroquette, for example. He could easily come up with a joke in any circumstance that was uproariously funny, much better than what we had there. He was a guy you often didn't argue with because he was just that good. We won an Emmy 4 times, and he would have won it more, but he resigned from the process. So there's another contingent heard from.
Yeah. We're almost out of time. We do have a caller here. We'll try to squeeze him in. Aurora, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, I'm a history buff, and I wondered why there weren't programs on with history in mind. Do you get my idea?
Well, my friend, there's many miniseries and movies that deal in history. There's an entire channel that deals with
history.
See, I don't history.
Have cable.
You mean just a popular network show that's all about history? For example, why isn't something that's on the History Channel not on network television? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
You know, I would have to say I think that would be wonderful. There used to be shows like that in the earlier days of television, Where Are They Now and things like that. And I think that would be wonderful. Again, if an audience could be found in network television for it, they would have it.
And it would seem to me the Katrina story would be something that might have a lot of information about writing a script for that, the Katrina story.
Oh, rest assured, you're going to see many projects, movies miniseries and TV miniseries based on the Katrina story. You can rest assured that's going to happen. By the way, I understand there's 6 movie companies right now in New Orleans filming movies.
Good. Thank you, David, for this wonderful story.
Sure.
Having him on. Have it on again sometime.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, I think we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish. I wish that we could keep talking. I'm sure we could find some other things to talk about.
Well, thanks, David. It's been a pleasure to be here. And I don't know if it's all right to plug my own lectures,
but
I'm lecturing Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night at Allen Hall about various show business topics. So if anybody is available to come down there, I'd love to see them.
Sure. Anybody should feel welcome. Fred Rubin, he's television screenwriter. He's guest in residence at Unit 1 at Allen Hall this week, 5th through the 9th. And you can go to Allen Hall and find out what's going on there. Anybody's welcome to any of these. He has served as a writer on 15 TV network series, been producer of a number of shows, and we mentioned some right now. He works as a freelance script consultant and also adjunct professor UCLA and USC in their departments of cinema and television. And he's a graduate of the University of Illinois.
Proud graduate.
1972, BFA in directing and playwriting. Well, again, thanks very much. It's been fun.
Thank you, David.